ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ओम नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Today we're reading the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, Chapter 57, verses 35 through 42, going up to the end of the chapter. The last verse is one of those benediction verses, so I think that we'll count the last verse together. I'll just read through the other verses, starting from text 35. Lord Krishna honored Akura, greeted him confidentially, and spoke pleasant words with him. Then the Lord, who is fully aware of Akura's heart, by virtue of his being the knower of everything, smiled and addressed him. O Master of Charity, surely the opulent Shamataka jewel was left in your care by Satadanga and is still with you. Indeed, we have known this all along. Purport. Lord Krishna's treatment of Akura here confirms that he's actually a great devotee of the Lord. 37. Since Satyajit has no sons, his daughter's son should receive his inheritance. They should pay for memorial offerings of water and pinda, clear their grandfather's outstanding debts, and keep the remainder of the inheritance for themselves. Report. Srila Sridhar Swami quotes the following Smriti injunction regarding inheritance. Patni duhi hitaras chaiva pitaro bhataras tata ha sutha gotara chapandhu Shisha cha sa brahmacharina. The inheritance goes first to the wife, then, if the wife has passed away, to the daughters, then to the parents, then to the brothers, then to the brothers' sons, and then to family members of the same gotra as the deceased, and then to his disciples, including brahmacharis. Srila Vishnu Chakravarti adds that since Satyajit had no sons, since his wives were killed together with him, and since his daughter Satyabhama was not interested in the Shamataka jewel, which constituted the inheritance, it rightfully belonged to her sons. In Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Srila Prabhupada explains, Lord Krishna indicated by the statement that Satyabhama was already pregnant, and that her son would be the real claimant of the jewel, and would certainly take the jewel from Akura if he tried to conceal it. A bit of hereditary law there. 38 and 39. Nevertheless, the jewel should remain in your care, O trustworthy Akura, because no one else can keep it safely. But please show the jewel just once, since my elder brother does not fully believe what I have told him about it. In this way, O most fortunate one, you will pacify my relatives. Everyone knows you have a jewel, for you are now continually performing sacrifices on altars of gold. Report. Although technically Satyabhama's sons had a right to the jewel, Lord Krishna decided to leave the jewel in the care of Akura, who was using the jewel's wealth to continually perform religious sacrifices. Indeed, Akura's ability to perform such rituals on altars of gold was an indication of the jewel's potency. 40. Thus, shamed by Lord Krishna's conciliatory words, the sons of Sapalka brought out the jewel from where he had concealed it in his clothing and gave it to the Lord. The brilliant gem shone like the sun. Report. We can see in this chapter how a valuable jewel caused so much intrigue, violence, and suffering. This is certainly a good lesson for those who desire a trouble-free spiritual life. After the Almighty Lord had shown the Shamataka jewel to his relatives, thus dispelling the false accusations against him, he returned it to Akura. Report. For the second time, doubts about the Lord's reputation occasioned by the Shamataka jewel are dispelled by the jewel itself. Indeed, for the second time, the Lord brought the jewel to Dwarka to establish his integrity there. This amazing series of incidents demonstrates that even when Lord Krishna descends to this world, there's a tendency for his peers to criticize him. The whole material world is infected by the fault-finding propensity, and in this chapter, the Supreme Lord demonstrates the nature of this undesirable quality. All right, let's read text 42 together, and we'll get the benediction of this chapter. Let's see if I can get the meter right here. Yaspetad Bhagavata Ishvarasya Vishnur. Viryadyam Vichivijina Haram Samangalam Cha. Akyanham Patati Srinot Vinushmaredva. Vistirtam Dharitam Apoyayati Shantyam. I don't know if there's a better meter. It's a couple short of the Govinda one, the Bhamma Sunita one. Oh, that sounds good. That sounds good. Okay. Yastvetad Bhagavata Ishvarasya Vishnur. Viryadhyam Vrijina Haram Sumangalam Cha. Akyanam patati shunoti nusmaredva. Vistirtam daritam apoyayati shantyam. Yastveta bhagavata ishvara shivishnor. Viryadyam vrijina haram sumangalam cha. Akhyanam bhati shrinoti nusmaredva. Vistirtam daritam apoyayati shantyam. Others? Yeah, whoever, to, indeed, etat, this, Bhagavata, of the personality of Godhead, Ishvarasya, the supreme controller, Vishnu, Lord Vishnu, Virya, with the prowess, Ahadyam, which is rich, Vijina, sinful reactions, Haram, which removes, Sumangalam, most auspicious, Cha, and Nakyanam, narration, Patati, recites, Shunoti, hears, Anusmare, remembers, Va, or, Dustirtakim, bad reputation, Duritam, and sins, Apoya, driving away, Yati, he attains, Shantim, peace. Translation by the disciples of the Prabhupada. This narration, rich with descriptions of the prowess of Lord Sri Vishnu, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, removes sinful reaction and bestows all auspiciousness. Anyone who recites, hears, or remembers it will drive away his own infamy and sins and attain peace. God. Thus ends the purports of the humble servants of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada to the 10th canto, 57th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam entitled Satyajit Murdered and the Jewel Returned. Om Ajnanatananda Shagnajana Sadakala Shakshari Kamina Kajna Shridhara Maha Panchakalpa Chudhisha Kudasindhidhidhacha Patitano Pavanadil Vaishnavi Namo Maha. Well, this concludes a very interesting chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam. One of the speakers recently said it was one of their favorite chapters. I guess because there's so much interest, so much intrigue, so many different plot twists, and different ideas expressed here. It's actually very, very interesting because it brings about, even sometimes questions, the character of Krishna and his devotees. What are they really doing? Balaram is accusing Krishna of, something, not quite telling the truth. Or, so it's a very, very interesting chapter in so many ways. They're quite different than some of the other Bhagavatam chapters, really. And there are many themes and lessons presented in this chapter of the Bhagavatam. I think particularly some of the last week I've noticed our speakers have been, quite good, I thought, quite expert at somehow bringing out many of the different points. And some of the intricacies that are here within these verses and within some of the purports that are here. And sometimes it's rather difficult because, we have just all of these sort of story points and, how to really get the whole philosophy out of this. So this is one of our challenges as speakers of the Bhagavatam, to really see what is it that Krishna is telling us, what are the Acharyas telling us about these very, very important topics. Today we heard about false accusations against Krishna and how he had to almost clear his name again for a second time with the Shamataka jewel and all the different ramifications of that. We heard about the laws of inheritance according to the Vedic standards, which is quite interesting, I thought, in its own way. And also that Krishna is all-knowing super soul, that he understood everything that was going on, and that he fully, more or less, divulged that the Kura really is a great devotee, and that he was fully aware of everything, and the Kura was playing his part in that. And finally, we get the benediction, that whoever hears the story is relieved of the burden of rumors, and even the sinful life that may have caused those rumors. So a very important chapter to hear and get that special blessing of Krishna from it. Overall, I think one of the main lessons we get here is that Krishna sometimes plays as an ordinary human being, and he's enjoying a leela with his devotees. So you might ask, well, why does he do this, or why did this character do this, or how did that happen, or this seems contradictory. It's really somewhat secondary. The point is that this is Krishna. Krishna is the all-powerful Supreme Personality of Godhead, but he chooses to come to this material world and, of course, also enact many similar, not all the same, but some similar pastimes in his eternal spiritual abode. This is what he chooses to do. And he enjoys his relationship with his devotees. And all of these different activities are meant to increase that rasa, that relationship, that love between him and his devotees. So he does this sometimes by playing as a human being. And sometimes he looks like he's an ordinary king or an ordinary husband or doing so many things. But this is all part of the leela. And at the same time, while he's absorbed in these pastimes, he remains the all-knowing super soul, as he reveals in verses 35 and 36. Most of this chapter is almost, I'd say 90% of it is over the purports, or directly purports from Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. In this particular verse, they chose not to give Vishvanath's full purport on it. Normally they do, but on text 35, the verse again, it's an interesting verse, an important verse, I thought. Was Lord Krishna honored Akura, greeted him confidentially, and spoke pleasant words with him. Then the Lord, who was fully aware of Akura's heart by virtue of his being the knower of everything, smiled and addressed him, "O Master of Charity, surely the opulent Shyamataka jewel was left in your care by Shatadanva and is still with you. Indeed, we have known this all along." So Srila Vishwanath says, the super soul knows everyone's heart, but Krishna knows all the super souls. So that's an interesting way of putting it, isn't it? The super soul knows everyone's heart, but Krishna knows all the super souls. Because Krishna is all the super souls, so naturally he knows all the super souls. And this is part of the verse he quotes, Vigyatikala Chitta Gya. Vigyatakila Chitta Gya. Chitta is heart, of course. Chitta. Chitta. Therefore, what is so remarkable if Krishna knows Akura's heart? Thus Krishna was smiling as he said, "You had no enmity against Sadhujit, nor did you steal the jewel. Moreover, you're not greedy for wealth. Rather, you are my exalted devotee. I know even the super soul who resides in you. So why are you afraid of me? What then can I ask of you since I already know everything?" So this is Krishna's position. It's almost like now it's kind of like at the end of the story or the end of the intrigue. He reveals his position. I've known this all along. I'm the super soul in your heart. I know the super souls in everybody's heart, you know, and I know that you're my great devotee, so why conceal anything from me? So sometimes this question comes up, and I always find it rather interesting myself, because we know that Krishna is omniscient. He is omnipotent. He knows everything. He's all-powerful. But yet he seems to suspend that role as the supreme. And he suspends that role in the service of his pastimes and his leelas. So that his pastimes and leelas are very prominent, and particularly in the Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, it's almost that the leelas are more important than the role of being the supreme lord of everything. I don't know if we could say more important, but they seem to take more prominence, or they're more central to his devotees. His devotees, especially in all of these, Vrindavan Leela, but also in Mathura and Dwarka Leela, they're more interested in their relationship with Krishna and Krishna's role or Krishna's position as being the supreme lord of everything. So examples of this, I was thinking of, one issue that Prabhupada gave. Prabhupada gave the example of the Supreme Court Justice. The Supreme Court Justice is on his bench, he's giving out, decisions about that are very, very important, that affect people's lives. He's on the Supreme Court. It's affecting national policy, affecting legal policy, legal standards and precedents. But when that Supreme Court justice goes home, he's the father, he's the husband, and his family. And they say he has a small child, and the child probably actually says, he may be the child is on his back, laying on his back. You know, does the child think, oh, this is the Supreme Court justice? No, child saying, this is my father, this is my dad. And he's just playing with him and enjoying that relationship with him. Now, the Supreme Court justice knows his role on the Supreme Court. He doesn't forget that. But he's not thinking that when he's playing with his son. He's thinking, I'm a father, and this is my son, and we're having a good time, and we're playing. So, you know, so it's something like that with Krishna and his pastimes. He's enjoying those pastimes with his devotees. Yes, he has this role of maintaining and creating universes over here. But that's not what he's absorbed in the moment. I gave the example the other day during class. We also sometimes see this this example if one is watching a movie or watching a play, and one becomes very absorbed in that play or that movie. And if somebody came up to you and said, well, this is really just a movie. You say, well, of course, I understand this is just a movie, but, leave me alone. I'm trying to enjoy it. I'm trying to get into it. I'm experiencing it. Now, and also, what if you were an actor in that play or that movie? And somebody came up to you and said, well, you're not really the king. You're just whoever you are. And I go, well, yeah, but I've got to get into this role. I have to think I'm the king. I have to play this part. You know, so, and I'm enjoying this part. And I'm enjoying the play. I'm enjoying the movie. So there's a word, it's kind of alliterative device called verisimilitude. It's kind of interesting. Verisimilitude, it means a willing suspension of disbelief. And it's also connected, it's usually connected with literature. And actually, the definition of this, I looked up, says verisimilitude means the semblance of reality in dramatic or non-dramatic fiction. The concept implies that either the action represented must be acceptable or convincing according to the audience's own experience or knowledge, or the audience must be enticed into willingly suspending disbelief and accepting improbable actions as true. Now, that's rather interesting, isn't it? Because we see that, we can almost kind of apply that with Krishna's pastimes. Because, not just the actors, not just the audience, but the actors and the characters have to fully enter into that drama. And when you think about it also, not only is Krishna the main actor, he's also the writer and the director. You know, and he runs the whole thing. Of course, sometimes, you know, to increase his pleasure, sometimes he leaves the directing, you know, to like Yogamaya, right? Sometimes Yogamaya will do the directing, the pastime, so he can just enjoy the pastimes more. Yogamaya, you set it up. Make it happen. That's like that. So he doesn't have to always be the director as well. So Krishna's devotees and Krishna himself enter into this sort of willing suspension of disbelief. Now, that disbelief is to enjoy Krishna as an ordinary person, not as the Supreme Lord. Because, of course, Krishna is God. But we have to sort of suspend that for the moment to be able to enjoy the pastime. Now, this is the difference between the devotee and the non-devotee. Now, for a non-devotee, if he's watching a movie or something, there's a great action hero, he has to suspend this belief that this ordinary person, this actor, who's probably not particularly even a great physical specimen or anything, is this great action hero and doing heroic things and doing wonderful things. You know, so he's, you know, you can't think, oh, this is just an actor. He can't do all this stuff. So, but it's the opposite for Krishna's pastimes. For the devotee, we know that Krishna is the Supreme Lord. We know that Krishna is the actual action hero, the one who can do everything, who can kill demons, who can create universes. So the devotee has to suspend that belief, you know, has to put that aside to think, this is just my son or my friend or my lover or whatever one's particular loss or relationship with Krishna is. So in some ways, for Krishna, his real pleasure, his real enjoyment, I mean, not that we can really, how do we understand what's God's enjoyment, God's pleasure, but to the degree that we understand from hearing the scriptures, from Srila Prabhupada and Acharyas, we understand that he takes the most pleasure in his relationships with his devotees, particularly in his Vrindavan pastimes, and these other pastimes too, like we're hearing in Porta. So in one sense, the creation and maintenance and destruction of universes sort of like his day job. Of course, you know, we have to beware of material analogies. I was almost reluctant to say that because, you know, in other words, whenever we use a material analogy, it's limited. You know, it has its limitations on how much we can describe of the spiritual, the divine, through our, you know, simple material words. So I don't mean day job like it's a negative thing, because all of Krishna's activities are equally important and relishable to devotees. Prabhupada explained that the devotee is just as eager to hear about Krishna killing the demons as Krishna with the gopis. In other words, these are all equal. Krishna is infinite. Krishna is unlimited. And everything he does is equally relishable and pleasurable. You know. But still, in some ways, the devotees and Krishna himself particularly enjoy the relationships, loving relationships with the devotees. But at the same time, we understand, as Krishna's devotees, that we want to hear everything about him. Very good. We have the most perfect example of this in our Acharyas, the six Goswamis of Vrindavan. What was their real identity? Aren't they all Manjari gopis? Some, you know, they're all very exalted devotees. I believe they are, aren't they? They're amongst the eight, you know, primary Manjaris. So here we have devotees in the most intimate confidential pastimes of Madhurya Leela. And what are they doing when it comes to the world? They're writing books of philosophy. Jiva Goswami Sundaras, aren't they the most exalted works of philosophy? So, in other words, the greatest devotees are not, do not shy away from understanding the depths of this Krishna conscious philosophy, the philosophy of Krishna. You know, because Krishna Tattva, what can be more important to the devotee but to understand everything about Krishna? Who Krishna is, why he does what he does, what does he do? It's all relishable to the devotee. So, in all of these activities, Krishna is revealing that he does know actually what has happened, that he is the super soul. He is all-knowing. He really wrote the script. He really knew what was happening. He was behind the scenes. And, you know, although he was playing a part at the same time, you know, he was on to it all. He was on to the plot from the very beginning. So, in this way, Krishna is the super soul. And the super soul is a very important aspect to the devotee. Sometimes we think, well, we're interested in Bhagavan realization, not Paramatma somehow, but yet the super soul, I've always found, is very interesting. Krishna's role as the super soul. In the Bhagavatam, actually in the second canto, Krishna enters into the mind of Vasudeva, and his form is called Vishvatma, which is another form of the super soul, Prabhupada explains. Prabhupada said, refers to one who is situated in everyone's heart. Another meaning of Vishvatma is the only lovable object for everyone. So the super soul who's situated in everyone's heart, this Vishvatma, is also the lovable object of everybody. So in other words, Krishna is not different than the Paramatma. It's not different than the super soul. One aspect of it. You know. Now, what does this mean to us? We're hearing here how Krishna is the super soul, knew Akura's heart, he knew everybody's heart, and he understood. So Krishna is knowing our hearts, the super soul, but he's also helping and guiding us as the super soul. Krishna is constantly helping the devotees and the conditioned souls to come back to him. And one of the ways he does is through the super soul, through his guidance. And he really does this in three ways, kind of like three steps. First of all, Krishna, you can kind of think of it as, I may be stretching this. It might fit into Sambandha, but anyway, it kind of loosely fits. First, he gives the initial intelligence. Super Soul gives us intelligence. Bhagavad Gita 10.10 says, Dhamma Buddha Yoga Nikam, I give the intelligence by which they can come to me. So, the Super Soul gives that intelligence that helps us to understand Krishna. And secondly, the super soul helps us to clear the anarchists within the heart. So, somewhat like, you know, the process, it helps with the process of devotional service. The part that at Ananta Nivritti stage, this is explained in 1-17. Srin Bhakam Sakatar Krishna, Krimya Shravana Krishna, Vidyam Teksto Vibhagyani, Vishnuti Subhitsana. Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is the Paramatma, super soul in everyone's heart, and the benefactor of truthful devotees, cleanses desires for material enjoyment from the heart of the devotee who has developed the urge to hear his message. So first the super soul, through the heart, helps us to understand Krishna. Then secondly, the super soul helps to cleanse the heart. Super soul in the heart is cleansing us, helping us to clear the anarthas, to go through the anarthamavritti stage, to make further advancement of Krishna consciousness. And then thirdly, the super soul continually enlivens the devotee. It's described how the super soul inspires the devotees and makes devotional service effortless. So I'm going to end with one of mine and probably many people's favorite verses, very well-known verse, but it's an ever-fresh verse. So here again, Srimad Bhagavatam 4:30-20, I'm going to read a verse in part of Purple of the Shri Prabhupada. And by the way, it's interesting. I was looking again at this chapter, and this was in instructions to householders. So this was talking about householder devotees. Always engaging in the activities of devotional service, devotees feel ever increasingly fresh and new in all of their activities. the all-knower, the super-soul within the heart of the devotee, makes everything increasingly fresh. This is known as the Brahman position by the advocates of the Absolute Truth. In such a liberated stage, Brahma-Bhuta, one is never bewildered, nor does one lament or become unnecessarily jubilant. This is due to the Brahma-Bhuta situation. And Srila Prabhupada's purport, a devotee is inspired by the super soul within the heart to advance in devotional service in a variety of ways. The devotee does not feel hackneyed or stereotyped, nor does he feel that he is in a stagnant position. In the material world, if one engages in chanting a material name, he will feel tired after chanting a few times. However, one can chant the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra all day and night and never feel tired. As chanting is increased, it will come out new and fresh. There is really nothing uninspiring for a highly advanced devotee. In the Bhagavad Gita, the Lord says he is situated in everyone's heart, and that he helps the living entity forget and remember. By the grace of the Lord, the devotee gets inspiration. As stated, those engaged in auspicious activities and devotional service are guided by the super soul, described in this word as Gya, one who knows everything, past, present, and future. The super soul gives instruction to the sincere, unalloyed devotee on how he can progress more and more in approaching the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srila Jiva Goswami says the super soul, the plenary expansion of the Personality of Godhead, exists in everyone's heart, but in the heart of a devotee, he reveals himself as ever increasingly new. Being inspired by him, the devotee experiences increased transcendental bliss in the execution of his devotional service. What's that? 4:30:20. Yeah, it was actually instructions to householders. Interesting. So, very inspiring verse in purport for Srila Prabhupada about how the super soul helps to inspire us to make devotional service ever increasing, always new. Sometimes we forget that. Sometimes it doesn't always seem so inspiring or so new or so fresh. We might feel I'm doing the same things repeatedly. But he gives Prabhupada's example. How do we chant 25,000 names of Krishna every single day, day after day, some of us for 40-some years? And we really do not become tired of it. The chanting does become, is ever fresh. And new and deeper realizations of chanting the holy name come about as we chant repeatedly, week after week, year after year, decade after decade. Yeah. And the service itself becomes inspired by Krishna within the heart. So if Krishna is inspiring the devotee within the heart in his devotional service, as Prabhupada says, it never will feel happy or stereotyped, and never will one be in a stagnant position. So I know devotees sometimes, we all feel that way sometimes. Sometimes it feels a little stagnant, or I'm not really getting anywhere, or I'm not advancing, or I'm not increasing in my devotional service. You know, but but if one is sincerely serving, and one becomes aware, becomes inspired, becomes a little bit in contact with the super soul, then one becomes increasingly inspired and finds those things that will inspire them in Krishna consciousness to increase, to advance, to take another step, to do something new perhaps, to increase one's devotional service. Anyway, that is there for every devotee. As Krishna is in the heart of every devotee, and as Srila Prabhupada is inspiring every devotee, we find those increasingly new understandings, new realizations, or new services to take up. You know, somehow or another, we try to help advance in Krishna consciousness and advance in this process of devotional service. Okay? All glories to Srila Prabhupada. Stop at that point. So, questions, comments? So, my last.
thing I've thought about for years is the first question is, you had mentioned at the beginning, just briefly touched on the point that usually it's on the Vrindavan level that the yoga maya really sets in, and you begin to feel personally obscured in favor of the sweetness and the more human-like that Krishna has. Now, of course, we go all the way to Vaikuntha, and in that direction, then we know that divinity is really in the forefront. But then when you get to Krishna in other parts of Vrindavan, actually the Dwarka, Mathura, it's kind of in the same general
region. All parts of Goloka. Yeah.
Goloka.
Yeah.
Then this we're hearing about now, it seems a little ironic that the divinity of Krishna seems to be going the whole nine yards to the high death, and sometimes almost humorously showing such a human facade, you can say. I think you kind of touched on that after you mentioned the issue.
Yeah, and it's in the Dwarka Leela, it seems to kind of cover and uncover, doesn't it? You know, I mean, because often there's a certain amount of awe and veneration, a certain amount of, you know, Krishna's there in his palace, and, you know, but, you know, even still, not that many people really knew. Prabhupada said at one time, we talked about this the other day, that only a handful of people, once Prabhupada heard say only maybe 50 people knew that Krishna was God. So there's a certain amount of covering, you know, that seems to be there, where not everyone is understanding. Obviously, his detractors didn't understand, or the demons didn't understand he was God. But apparently, even his devotees didn't always understand his position. And of course, it seems as though that would sort of cover and uncover for the benefit of the pastimes, you know, to increase the leela, or, you know, as needed.
The question: how much do you need? I mean, before you kind of suspect. If there is a God, this just may be God.
Yeah.
You have, your king not only is incredibly opulent, but he coalesces 16,000 and comes into the assembly hall.
And even still, they were criticizing. Maybe he stole the Shamadagar's
will. Yeah, I mean, it's a little ironic because you usually associate this obfuscation with God. A little more interesting, more fundamental question. Is Krishna really acting? I mean, nato, natra, daro, yata, kinkunti says, just like an actor is covered by a curtain, maya, gopamaya, whatever, just as an actor on a stage is not recognized by the audience. It would seem that if it's really, we take it literally, that Krishna is feigning all these things and acting, and sometimes we do that language. But then how could he enjoy, and how could the rasa be natural? It would seem like Krishna allows himself to actually feel fear, as you can be pointed out at the Rupi Sutta, Madhya Yasoda. So is he acting, or is he allowing himself to be overcome by the role? So that way the experience would be very natural.
Yeah, I'd probably rather you answer that, Maharaj, but...
the answer, didn't you?
I think what we're sort of seeing is its goal to some degree. I mean, I think that was the point I was trying to make, that Krishna both knows that everything is going on, at the same time he allows himself to enter into the leela. Because as you said, he has to somehow think, oh, Mother Yashoda's really coming with a whipping stick. I mean, I can't, how could he possibly even, you know, pretend to be in that leela without somehow, you know, at least partially, and yes, this is, I am in this position. Mother Yashoda. Yeah.
I'm just saying.
But he also.
How could he enjoy like that?
Yeah, that's exactly it. He has to engage in the leela to enjoy. And it's described that he does enjoy these, you know, the different gossips, the different leaders, so, you know, the world by side of the past. You know, so, yes, I mean, I, as far as I understand, my very limited understanding of this is its goal. He's engaging, you know, fully absorbing himself as an actor, just, you know, who might temporarily forget, you know how they are, but it's method acting. Or somebody, I don't know much about acting, but probably maybe you know something about it. But isn't there a time when you try to absorb yourself so much into the character, like be the character, you know, so you actually are starting to think like the character, right? And act like them, and you know, what would this character actually do if I was really this character? It seems like Krishna has to get into the character almost to that degree. Yeah. Yeah.
Oba said that, not his own mouth.
Wants to follow up on it. Our acting expert here.
Yeah, I was going to say, in theater, the actor voluntarily, by studying the character and the circumstance the character's in, he voluntarily encloses himself in a bubble, the actor's bubble, which everything is outside of that. He can forget about his so-called real life, and even the audience, and that he's on the stage. And he's functioning only as that character, voluntarily. But what happens is that the rasa, the idea of theater is rasa, that Rupa Goswami pointed out. We want to, that's why the demigods asked Lord Brahma to give them something where they could have rasa without karma, you know, without any implications for their life. So the rasa is real. It takes place in the actor on the stage. And that's what the audience want. They want rasa. They want to see. They want the hairs to stand on end, feel compassion and cry.
Yeah, so Krishna can't just pretend. He has to, right?
Well, it's real.
It has to be real. It has to be a real relationship.
Yeah.
Gemma Smith, I think, is next to me. Thank you.
For those on the Baiti Sadhana platform, this discussion about taking promptings from superstars. First, the challenge is sometimes how to determine whether it's supersoul or
active mind.
I mean, speaking about the Brahma-Buddha platform, you know, I think that's described in 4:30:20.
Yeah, Brahma Buddha is mentioned that verse,
That's a description that takes place in the Brahma Buddha platform, but for those of us that are still aspiring, it's a bit challenging to actually know what to do, you know, when the circumstances are difficult, and it's difficult to really see the way ahead. And how to access Super Soul in these situations, and that's the challenge for the world.
Yeah. You know, one thing... it occurred to me that, of course, you know, we know the formula of, you know, sadhu, shastra, guru. In other words, is what I think Super Soul is inspiring me to, is it also consistent with the instructions of the spiritual master, with the scriptures, you know, with the acharyas? And we also can extend sadhu, I think, to, you know, our senior devotees, any senior devotees that we respect. So a lot of times it's good to check things out. You know, in other words, I have this wonderful idea, and all of my god brothers and god sisters think it's crazy. Well, maybe I should rethink it. If everyone's encouraging me and saying, that's really a great idea, go for it, then I might think that, you know, it gives me a little more evidence, you know, that it might actually be a good inspiration. But I was also thinking that sometimes, people would write Prabhupada and question after question, and sometimes they were kind of like minor things. And a couple times Prabhupada would write down and say, sometimes, well, use your intelligence. And said, if you don't have intelligence, find someone that does have intelligence. Yeah. But so, in other words, what is intelligence? Prabhupada also said, intelligence is the form direction of Super Soul, right? In other words, how does Super Soul manifest to the devotee? One way that he manifests is through our intelligence, by giving us intelligence about how to do things. So we do experience the Super Soul in that way, giving us intelligence in our service to be able to perform and to do things. And, and usually if it seems like we're having good results and the service is going in a good way, and, you know, and Krishna is directing us in that way, the Super Soul. And usually, you know, if we're really getting really off, someone usually tells us, you know, or we get some disconfirming evidence in some way that, you know, this is really not going in the right place. Yeah. And sometimes take another direction that you open up the question. And sometimes we just really know that we're being inspired by Krishna. And devotees do get realization, and Krishna does inspire us. And sometimes we feel that within the heart. We can be wrong, but it does happen. Within the heart.
What's this one from that? The Shruti Palam, the benediction from this verse?
Okay.
The benediction that the
last verse
of the chapter?
Uh-huh.
If we could actually see how that actually takes place, as the devotee understands these different aspects of Krishna, his thinking changes, and his, or is it that it takes place that your destiny all of a sudden has changed, or your, you know, or how you're dealing with your, with the.
Well, it could be all of the above, you know. And but you know, on this benediction, see, I'm very simple minded about these things. And I take these things just at face value. I just take it that you hear it, and in some mystical way, Krishna gives you some benediction, that you become purified by the process of hearing. Hearing the Srimad Bhagavatam is in itself auspicious, right? Purifying through the heart. Now, it also, you know, those other things might happen. We might understand certain things. Certain realizations might come about through the narration. It could be on an intellectual platform. But I think it tends to, I tend to think these things just more on the spiritual platform of, you know,
it's also
power of hearing.
If you've never heard these things before, and then once you hear them, you're permanently being enlightened because you've heard it, and now you don't think the same, you don't perceive reality.
I think that the average living entity would not be picking up Srimad Bhagavatam and reading the 57th chapter of the 10th canto. You know, in other words, there is, you've already qualified to some degree to get to this point that you're reading this chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam. Yeah. Last word we should end in class.
You break down the word to word. They say, it says Padvati, one who recites, then Sunati. We are reciting the verse. Sunati means one who hears.
Reciting,
so one who is reciting, one, and then Anusmare, one who remembers.
One who remembers.
That's how the translation becomes.
So you have to hear, you have to chant, you have to speak it, hear it, and remember it.
Remember. Then you get three results. This is what, while you are reading the translation, word to word, it says that you get. First one is Duskritim, that's the word.
Uh-huh.
Means the bad reputation, in fame you will go away. The second one was the sinful, and its root also, root of the sin. And the third one is Santim, the last word, I think, Santim, peace. You get peace, you become peaceful.
Yeah, it's very significant, isn't it?
Yeah. I was going to mention to my further little extension of Maharaj's. Very nice. And Adilila 4th chapter, there's the one verse, I don't know the number. It says, Amita na jani ke hai na jane gopi gaan, duha rupe gune duha nitka hare maan. So Srila Prabhupada gave a beautiful purport. He says, where Lord Krishna instructed Jogamaya how to display this lila. That cover my majesty and powers, that I will be acting just like an ordinary human being. So as the gopis and all the covered boys, everybody will be also covered. And we'll just be attracted by our natural characteristics, beauty and harmonious loveliness. And but in between, the inconceivable potency is manifested. In the second canto also, Srila Prabhupada said that Lord Krishna is very astonished every moment by the arrangement of Jogamaya, how she is arranging for the Lord to release. So Srila Jiva Goswami give a little elaborate on that Supreme Absolute Truth always in Atmaram, the self-satisfied, means that the pleasure potency is within him, serving him and kept him completely merged into bliss. The potency is always there, but it's not visible. But then that stage is like a person who is feeling happy that he's breathing and he's alive. But when his breath sometime passed through a bamboo called flute, that same breath of air that produces such a melodious sound that the player himself is astonished and charmed. His own breathing or air that coming through another bamboo producing such a attraction that he is very astonished. It is more, much more, 10 million times more attractive than his breathing without that. So that flute or that bamboo is that Ladini potency. So Krishna, in that sense, he is more attracted to relishing through loving exchange, and he literally, as a Krishna aspect, forgot his supremacy or supreme power.
Although the person didn't exactly say that, they talked about how he covered, yeah. so that his devotees were covered in that scene of supremacy. First, the verse about the bamboo, the bamboo flute, so much says that. But he also becomes absorbed in
that. Yes.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. I'm sure we can find these, but it's a very, it's a difficult point. Kind of a
I just want to say that example. For an example, like you gave, like example that the devotee's loving exchange becomes so intense, it is so relishing. Like one time in Damodar Lila, Balaram was not there until Mother Yashoda tied Krishna. And Balaram came, and he was surprised that Krishna has been tied with a mortar. And then he says, who has done this? And then Sudam came, shh, Mother. So then Balaram says, I was here, she would not have done this. But somehow that Balaram felt that Krishna has got stuck, he can't play, he wants to go and play. So then he went inside and spoke to Mother Yashoda. Maya, do you know who I am? I'm supreme. And Krishna is origin of me. He is the supreme personality of Godhead origin. All the universe and unlimited potency, all these universes emanating from us. And he gave a whole speech. And Mother Yashoda looked at him and said, one more word, I'll tie you up. And Balaram ran and ran.
Okay, I'll go to Shri Prabhupada.